Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, June 25th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article titled Local History, Lauding Local Legend and Legacy. We have a photo of Reverend Thomas Walker and his wife Margaret posing under a new street sign for the honorary Dr. Thomas E. Walker Street in front of Walker Funeral Services in Decatur on Tuesday, June 24th. Decatur men honored for serving community in street naming events. From Valerie Wells in Decatur. Two streets in Decatur have been given honorary new names to honor men dedicated to service to their community. On Saturday, the John C. Ellis Lodge 17 of the Free and Accepted Masons dedicated a section of East Marietta Street, the Dr. John C. Ellis Parkway. On Tuesday, a section of North Water Street was dedicated to the Reverend Thomas Walker, a pastor of Main Street Church of the Living God. Ellis was the first African-American doctor in Decatur, Grand Master of the Prince Hall Masons of Illinois from 1924 to 1944, the longest-serving Grand Master in the Masons' history. He was one of the founders of Decatur Memorial Hospital, then known as Decatur and Macon County Hospital, and practiced medicine in the community from 1915 to 1946. He died in 1963 at the age of 78. Walker is the founder of Main Street Church and involved in a number of businesses, such as Walker Funeral Home and Chapel, where the section of Water Street now known as Dr. Thomas E. Walker Street is located. Tuesday also happened to be Walker's 75th birthday. This is a great man, and that's something that you all already know, said City Manager Tim Gleason, one of several speakers at the event, which drew a large crowd of family, fellow pastors, friends, and colleagues. Walker's son Corey, founder of the Ink Spot, a small business incubator in Decatur, said his dad began his career in California, where he intended to pursue a life in the entertainment industry, but his destiny lay elsewhere. One of the things that Walker always says, Corey Walker said, is, "This is the day that the Lord has made," and Walker said that when he spoke at the end of the ceremony. "I want to thank people who made this possible," Reverend Walker said. "I would not be who I am if not for you. I thank God for my wife, Margaret. I'm overjoyed to be here today because we don't know what tomorrow will bring." Walker attended a conference in Montgomery, Alabama last week, and on the way back, the car hydroplaned and was totaled. No one was hurt, and the family had bought a new limousine for use by the funeral home, so they had a ride home. "Sometimes there's no other help to be had but the Lord," Walker said. Several of his grandchildren spoke to wish him a happy birthday and credit Papa with setting a godly example. "We just honored him on Sunday for being a Decatur legend," said Tanya Fuller of the Greater Decatur Black Chamber of Commerce and the Ink Spot. "We appreciate everything you've done for our community." The Reverend Todd McClellan, pastor of City of Praise Church, teased Walker that only for you would he wear a suit in such hot weather. The prophets in the Bible, he said, were referred to as servants of God for their faith, their obedience, and their leadership. "We must remember, we must understand that God's servant refers to an individual who is devoted to serving God's will and often serving others in a selfless and humble manner," McClellan said. "Today there is such a man in Dr. Thomas Walker." At Saturday's event, Worshipful Master Larry Harvey led the dedication ceremony to name the section of Marietta Street in honor of Ellis, who was a member of the lodge that now bears his name. "That lodge," Harvey said, "has produced four Grand Masters who serve as the head of the Free and Accepted Masons in the state." "Ellis left an enduring legacy," said Junior Warden Mario Tobar. "By naming the street after John C. Ellis, we're not only honoring his past service, but also inspiring future generations," Tobar said. "The street will serve as a constant reminder of his legacy and a symbol of the values he embodied. We set aside this moment to express our sincere thanks to John C. Ellis for his innumerable contributions. May the street honor his memory and continue to inspire us all." Again from the front page, from the Chicago Tribune, Rick Pearson, Illinois Politics. Pritzker to seek third term in 26. Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker will announce Thursday that he will seek a third term next year, answering a question about his immediate political future, but leaving unanswered whether he will pursue a longer-term goal of running for president in 28. Multiple sources close to Pritzker's campaign confirmed to the Tribune on Tuesday that the governor will make an announcement at in-person events in Chicago and Springfield, though exact details of what it will entail have not yet been finalized. Democratic supporters on Monday were invited to a campaign announcement for Pritzker, but were not told the details. He's the first incumbent governor to seek a third term as chief executive since the late former Republican governor James R. Thompson, who went on to serve four terms. Illinois has no term limits on its constitutional offices. Pritzker's decision becomes the most significant in a series of moves in the early 26 political season that is poised to remake Illinois' political landscape. The generational domino effect has already seen longtime politicians opt to retire or pursue higher office, moves that have created new openings for political ladder climbers beneath them. But the governor's move also allows Illinois' ruling Democrats to breathe a sigh of relief, leaving in place the powerful billionaire force who has led them both politically and financially for the past 6.5 years. It also helps the party avoid the prospect of a fractious, contentious, and costly primary battle to succeed him. With his two-term running mate, Juliana Stratton, among the contenders seeking to replace retiring senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Pritzker does have to decide who will join him on the ticket as a lieutenant governor candidate, and who has his confidence to succeed him if he embarks on a successful presidential bid. Pritzker spent $350 million of his own wealth in his two successful runs for governor and heavily invested in the state Democratic Party that he funded and controlled. He spent tens of millions of dollars on building up the state Democratic Party, local ward, township, and county organizations, and contributed to the leadership funds of House Speaker Emanuel, Chris Welch, and Senate President Don Harmon to ensure state legislative supermajorities. Republicans had their run with a wealthy benefactor, one-term venture capitalist Governor Bruce Rauner, but the businessman had trouble understanding government and politics, lost GOP support, and was easily defeated by Pritzker in 18. With Rauner gone, the state GOP and its legislative leaders have seen his money dry up and have been at a serious financial disadvantage ever since. Pritzker, a 60-year-old entrepreneur and heir to the Hyatt Hotels fortune, is one of the nation's wealthiest politicians with a net worth of $3.7 billion, according to Forbes. President Donald Trump is estimated by Forbes to be worth $5.5 billion. Pritzker has yet to formally declare an interest in the 28 Democratic presidential nomination, but his actions over the past year suggest presidential ambitions as he has sought to expand his national footprint. In 2023, he founded a national organization to advocate for abortion rights in the states. In that same year, he played a key role in bringing the 24 Democratic National Convention to Chicago, where last year he played host to party leaders from across the country. But it was Pritzker's February State of the State address to state lawmakers, 1 month into Trump's second term, where he gained national attention by likening the rise of the Trump 2.0 era to Nazism in 1930s Germany. "I do not invoke the specter of Nazis lightly," said Pritzker, who is Jewish, and helped found the state's Holocaust Museum. He added that he was watching with a foreboding dread what is happening in our country right now. Pritzker's speech, which occurred as National Democrats were largely leaderless in countering and criticizing Trump's early chaotic presidential moves, aimed to fill the vacuum and garnered significant attention by offering a searing response to the president for a national audience. The speech quickly launched Pritzker into national media interviews, ranging from traditional print, broadcast, and cable outlets to The View and Jimmy Kimmel Live, as well as myriad podcasts. He also became a featured keynote speaker for some state Democratic organizations, including an April appearance in New Hampshire where he called for mass protests for mobilization for disruption against Republicans to protest the Trump administration. "These Republicans cannot know a moment of peace," he said. "They must understand that we will fight their cruelty with every megaphone and microphone that we have. We must castigate them on the soapbox and then punish them at the ballot box." The Trump administration and allied Republicans criticized Pritzker for fomenting violence, something the Democratic governor called absurd coming from a president who helped incite the deadly U.S. Capitol riot on January 6th, 21, that was aimed at blocking Trump's election loss. Pritzker has described his increased national visibility as an attempt to showcase Illinois as a bulwark against the president's policies, rather than seeds for a future presidential campaign. There are things going on outside the state of Illinois that have terrible negative effects on the people of Illinois, and I'm talking about what's happening in Washington, D.C., he said May 25th. So the purpose, of course, is to make sure that we're having our voices heard, that we're impacting the federal discussion, and hopefully preserving the services that people in Illinois have frankly paid for and deserve. Even before the DNC and the State of the State speech, Pritzker had been on the national radar because of his wealth and being the chief executive of the sixth largest state in the nation. He also was a finalist to become Kamala Harris's running mate when she ascended to become the nominee after former President Joe Biden dropped out of the 24 race. Pritzker has noted that the vetting he underwent to appear on the short list of vice presidential running mates was an indication of the belief that he had the qualifications to do the job of president. Perhaps Pritzker's biggest accomplishment as governor was to bring a state of fiscal stability to a notoriously unstable Illinois, particularly after the financial problems caused by his GOP predecessor's two-year stalemate with Democratic lawmakers that left the state without a budget, causing severe cuts in social safety net programs and racking up a vast amount of unpaid bills to state vendors. The state's credit rating has been upgraded 9 times during Pritzker's tenure, from a low point of being one step above junk bond status. Still, in seeking future fiscal stability for the state, Pritzker did suffer his most significant political loss, the 2020 voter rejection of his signature plan to change the state constitution to replace the mandated flat rate income tax with a graduated income tax with higher rates based on income. Pritzker contributed $58 million to the pro-amendment Vote Yes for Fairness campaign. However, his push was opposed by Ken Griffin, then one of Illinois' wealthiest individuals and the founder and CEO of the Citadel Hedge Fund, an investment group. Griffin gave $53.75 million to the coalition to stop the proposed tax hike amendment. In 2024, the political feud between Pritzker and Griffin continued as Griffin invested $50 million in a Republican challenger to Pritzker, Richard Ervin, who was then the mayor of Aurora. But as Ervin was headed to defeat in the GOP primary, Griffin announced he and Citadel were leaving Illinois for Florida. An unabashed progressive, Pritzker has increased protections for abortion access for women and availability of health care, defended the state's sanctuary policies against Trump's push to deport immigrants, signed bans on assault weapons and so-called ghost guns, and required universal background checks on firearms in the states. At the same time, he enacted changes to the state's criminal justice system that ended cash bail for nonviolent offenders, expunged minor cannabis-related arrest records, and approved the legalization of marijuana for recreational sale and use. He also approved a $15 an hour state minimum wage and a massive $45 billion capital plan, Rebuild Illinois, to modernize the state's infrastructure. He adopted programs offering tax credits for electric vehicle development and is pushing to make the state a center for quantum computing. He also legalized sports betting and helped create 6 new casino licenses. But his tenure has not been without controversy. His stewardship of the state during the COVID-19 pandemic was roundly criticized as overreach by Republicans, with some municipal leaders ignoring business shutdown orders. Several GOP county sheriffs vowed not to enforce the state's assault weapons ban. A state audit faulted Pritzker's Department of Public Health for its tardy response to a COVID-19 outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home in 20 that killed 36 elderly military veterans. An inspector general's report, ordered by Pritzker, was found to have focused too narrowly on the State Department of Veterans Affairs while largely ignoring public health's role in the crisis. Another state audit found Pritzker's Department of Employment Security paid out more than $5 billion in fraudulent jobless benefits in the rush to fulfill jobless claims during the pandemic. and another 300 state employees engaged in wrongdoing by receiving more than $7 million of pandemic-era business grants to assist businesses in paying workers. At a May 28 event, Pritzker told reporters he was proud of the job he has done as governor heading into the final days of a legislative session made complicated by budget uncertainty over Trump's actions and effects on the economy. "I am who I am. I think you've all seen me operate. You know what I believe in," the governor said, touting his efforts to push economic development. "I believe very strongly that we need to grow our economy while we're also taking care of the most vulnerable in our society, not to mention preserving the services that working families deserve," he said. "And that's the way I've operated for 6.5 years, and I'll continue to operate." Now from our opinion page, our topic is diagnosing Medicaid. And we'll read the first column from David M. Walker, who is a former Comptroller General of the United States. He wrote this for InsideSources.com, titled, "Surge in Spending Demands Restraint." The debate in Washington over reducing spending on Medicaid should not be framed solely as a fight over cuts. It should focus on reform. America needs to rein in the cost of Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, without compromising the safety net for those who are in need. From 2019 to 2024, federal spending on these programs surged 53%, from $409 billion to $626 billion. During that period, inflation and population growth combined to total 28%. Improper payments under Medicaid and CHIP were estimated at $32 billion in 2024. No private sector organization would sustain that increase and level of waste without acting. Taxpayers deserve greater accountability, and vulnerable Americans require a stable safety net. Reform does not mean abandonment. It means modernization, targeting, responsibility, and accountability. Congress should take several steps to address this. First, enact and enforce work requirements for able-bodied adults without dependent children. Medicaid and similar programs must serve as springboards to independence, not long-term crutches. Requiring work, job training, or community engagement restores accountability, fosters personal responsibility, and reinforces the dignity that comes with self-sufficiency. Second, terminate the remaining COVID-19-era expansions of Medicaid and CHIP. The public health emergency is long over. It's time to roll back the extraordinary measures that were meant to be temporary. Allowing them to linger drives up costs and dilutes the focus of these programs, preventing them from helping those in need. Third, restrict federal Medicaid funding to documented residents only. Emergency services for undocumented immigrants may remain, but such coverage should be the responsibility of states that choose to provide it, without federal reimbursement. Continuing to subsidize such coverage invites further undocumented immigration and undermines enforcement efforts. Fourth, crack down on state-level reimbursement schemes that exploit loopholes to game the federal match. These practices siphon taxpayer dollars and distort the original purpose. Federal authorities must strengthen oversight and impose penalties to end those backdoor budget gimmicks and abuses. Fifth, tighten federal oversight by enhancing audits, upgrading internal controls, and ramping up enforcement. Fraud, waste, and abuse must be aggressively rooted out. While some level of error is inevitable in large systems, tolerance for it never should be. Every misallocated dollar is a missed opportunity to support someone who genuinely needs help. Finally, lawmakers should consider capping federal costs and providing states more flexibility through block grants with minimal federal standards. States understand their populations better and can design more efficient, effective programs as long as accountability is in place. Reforming Medicaid and CHIP is just one piece of a larger puzzle. The broader U.S. healthcare system is unsustainable. Healthcare costs are the second largest driver of future federal spending, behind only interest on the debt. And despite spending more of our economy on healthcare than any other nation, our outcomes are below average for an industrialized nation. That is unacceptable. We must move away from the fee-for-service model, which rewards volume over value. Instead, payments should promote better care at a lower cost. prescription drugs need expanded price negotiation and a ban on direct-to-consumer advertising. Liability reform is also long overdue to curb unnecessary services and reduce malpractice litigation. In the long term, we must reconsider the federal role in public health and health care. One option is a universal, publicly funded plan that covers preventive, wellness, and catastrophic care. Americans could purchase supplemental coverage. Medicaid and CHIP have grown dramatically and are inefficient and vulnerable to abuse. Delaying action puts taxpayers and those in need at risk. Our public health and fiscal future depend on getting this right. We'll read the second half of the opinion page in part two. Please stay tuned. From national and international news, Powell says Fed will hold off on rate cut from Washington. The Federal Reserve will continue to wait and see how the economy evolves before deciding whether to reduce its key interest rate, Chair Jerome Powell said Tuesday, a stance directly at odds with President Donald Trump's call for immediate cuts. For the time being, we are well positioned to wait to learn more about the likely course of the economy before considering any adjustments to our policy stance, Powell said in testimony Tuesday before the House Financial Services Committee. Several Republicans on the committee pushed Powell to consider reducing borrowing costs more quickly, as soon as its next meeting at the end of July. But on the whole, the hearing was uniformly polite, and Powell did not face sharp criticism over the Fed's decision to leave its rate unchanged. Briefly, federal lawsuit. Attorneys general from more than 20 states in Washington, D.C. filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday challenging billions of dollars in funding cuts made by the Trump administration that would pay for everything from crime prevention to food security to scientific research. Confidence. The Conference Board said Tuesday that its Consumer Confidence Index slid to 93 in June, down 5.4 points from 98.4 last month, which represented a brief uptick. The regression surprised economists who expected a small increase this month. Ukraine war. Russian drones, missiles, and artillery killed at least 26 civilians and injured more than 200 others in Ukraine, officials said Tuesday, as President Vladimir Zelensky sought guarantees at a NATO summit of further Western help to repel Moscow's invasion. Power outage. Dutch authorities investigated possible sabotage against the rail network on Tuesday after a power outage left the country's main airport with limited train services as a two-day summit of NATO leaders was opening in the Netherlands. Pride flag. Atlanta police said Tuesday that three men and a juvenile could face hate crime charges after they pulled down LGBTQ+ pride flags and cut them up at an intersection known as the center of the city's LGBTQ+ community. Mozambique. At least 120 children were kidnapped by jihadist insurgents in northern Mozambique in recent days, Human Rights Watch said Tuesday, warning of a rise in abductions in the country's troubled Cabo Delgado province. Mozambique has been battling the Islamist insurgency in Cabo Delgado since 2017. From the Gaza Strip, Israel kills 44, Gaza officials say. Military attacks, people waiting for aid as death toll surpasses 56,000. Israeli forces and drones open fire on hundreds of Palestinians waiting for aid in separate incidents in southern and central Gaza early Tuesday, killing at least 44, witnesses in hospitals said, as health authorities announced the number of Palestinians killed in the war past 56,000. The new food distribution sites run by an American contractor with U.S. and Israeli government support have been plagued by violence and chaos since opening last month. Palestinian witnesses and health officials say Israeli forces repeatedly opened fire on crowds heading to the sites for desperately needed food, killing hundreds in recent weeks. The military claims it fired at people it said approached its forces in a suspicious manner while going to the sites. In central Gaza, three witnesses told the Associated Press that Israeli forces opened fire as people advanced toward aid trucks south of Wadi Gaza. It was a massacre, said Ahmed Halawa. He said tanks and drones fired at people even as we were fleeing. Many people were either martyred or wounded. Hossam Abu Shahada said drones were flying over the area watching the crowds. Then there was gunfire from tanks and drones as people moved eastward. He described a chaotic and bloody scene as people tried to escape. Israel's military said it was reviewing the incident, which took place near the Netzarim corridor, a road that separates northern and southern Gaza. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry said Israel's 21-month military operation in Gaza has killed 56,077 people. The war was sparked by Hamas's surprise attack on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, that killed about 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and took 251 others hostage. Many have been released by ceasefire or other agreements. The death toll is by far the highest in any round of Israeli-Palestinian fighting. The ministry said the dead include 5,759 who have been killed since Israel resumed fighting on March 18th, shattering a two-month ceasefire. The ministry doesn't distinguish between civilians and combatants, but says more than half of the dead were women and children. Gun violence. Worshippers lament. 10 years after shooting, Charleston AME Church sees few changes in U.S. From the Associated Press, Jeffrey Collins. On a horrible night in 2015, nine black church members were gunned down by a white man who hated them just for the color of their skin. He sat with them through their Bible study at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston. Then as they closed their eyes and bowed their heads, he started firing. Just as they did 10 years ago, people of faith gathered June 17th in the church's fellowship hall searching for God's truth and love. They invite another congregation that knows the pain of murderous hatred to join them. When a gunman killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, Mother Emanuel's pastor, the Reverend Eric Manning, flew to Pittsburgh to comfort another flock. This month, it was up to Rabbi Jeff Myers to lament that the world hasn't changed as much as was hoped for by the congregation of the South's oldest African-American church. Founded by enslaved people, it was torn down after they rebelled and then rebuilt following the Civil War. Mother Emanuel's sanctuary continues its mission of empathy, empowerment, encouragement, and equipping, and the nation still struggles with the legacy of enslaving black people for hundreds of years. On June 17th, rapturous applause rained down when survivors of the shooting and relatives of the people killed were asked to stand and be seen. Chris Singleton, whose mother Sharonda Coleman Singleton was killed, asked everyone to hug somebody who looks different than you, and for several minutes the packed sanctuary was abuzz with smiling people, arms reaching over pews, and hugs spilling into aisles. Large photos of those killed were on display in the sanctuary. The shooter sprayed more than 70 bullets to kill them and told Polly Shepherd he was leaving her alive so the world would know his motive. You're taking over our country, and you have to go. He failed, Manning said. People of faith are still here, working together for good through God. Let the memory of the Emanuel 9 be a light that guides us, he said, not only to remembrance, but also to renewal and change. This article was excerpted. Please see the full article in the E-Edition Plus. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, June 25th. Please stay tuned.